So we've arrived at Deuteronomy 12, and one of the commentators, I think maybe Kaufman, pointed out that the first verse here is a title, etc., a heading in the original text, and sort of serves as a divider between the previous 11 chapters and then the next several chapters. So we can see this divide, even if you didn't read the original and know that this is a title or a heading. We can see it just in the context. We have 11 chapters that we've gone through that recount the trials and tribulations of God's people as they travel through the wilderness. And we saw Moses retelling all of the key points along their journey. And he ended, I actually wasn't here last week, but those of you who are here studied chapter 11, which talked about the blessings they would receive when they cross into the promised land. And it ends by saying, you will cross over the Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and you will possess it and dwell in it, and you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today. So he's recounted this whole history and said, and now we're going to talk about statutes and judgments. And then verse 1 here says, these are the statutes and judgments. And so now we have a new section. We're done to some degree with the history and recounting what led them up to where they are now. And now we're going to talk about statutes and judgments, which they're going to observe, they're going to bring into the promised land when they get there. Okay, so the first question, and I believe this will be for Malin. In addition to abstaining from idolatry and all its practices, how did God want Israel to oppose false religion?
In the first given, we see that they were to be proactive and destroy, you know, all of the idol worship items and the places there. They were to completely remove all those idolatrous things from the lands that they had been given. And, you know, by completely removing them and destroying them, you know, nothing that was there could be associated with worshiping the true Lord. And so, kind of remove everything, worship correctly.
Okay, so Malin says remove. It says utterly destroy, just a bit more than removing, but I think you're exactly right. It was to get rid of anything that wasn't related to the true God. Other comments?
And there are a couple different, within verses 2 and 3, things that are supposed to be removed and taken care of, destroyed. Verse 2 is more about the places of worship, these groves, the things that set up for worship. And verse 3 is more the items. It seems like of worship, the idols, the pillars that are used in those ceremonies. I think it was Ellicott had an observation on this I hadn't thought of. So this was obviously something for Israel to do, to remove that temptation for idolatry, for this false worship for them. But this also would have been perhaps an aid to the Canaanites that did remain, that perhaps would have potentially come over, worship the one true God, to remove that temptation from them as well. So it would have helped both ways. And that reminded me of us today and the things like that we have in our lives, the sin, situations, whatever that we have in our lives, and how not only can that affect us, but it can affect not just those that we even interact with, but those from afar can see that and be affected by the things that we don't remove, those high places and hills that we allow to remain in our hearts. We've talked about it in the past, you know, some of the symbolism behind these, the mountains supposedly bringing one closer to the heavens, to gods within that, the green trees, there's some sort of cultic aspect to that, the shade and the darkness, the coolness, that connection with nature. But I think it's very interesting that in verse 2, the phrase, utterly destroy the high mountains and on the hills, under every green tree. There are three things mentioned there specifically to destroy. And then, I don't know how many hundreds of years later, but in 2 Kings 16, verse 4, it talks about King Ahaz of Judah, and it uses this exact same phrase in the opposite sense. It says, he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. So that transition from, you know, here this was so integral to the law of Moses to stick to God, to remove all these traces of idolatry, and then we know from later in Israel's history, it was this constant tug of war. A good king would remove these high places, these monuments, and then a bad king would put them back up, you know, and some would be removed, some would remain, you know. It was this constant cultural tug of war with the people. And then verse 4, without getting too much into the next question, shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. I think the items of worship in verse 3 are in play there, but also with the where and the how. You know, I think the point of that, and we'll see it in the next section, is God cared and cares today, I think, where and how he's worshipped.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Interesting point. Other comments? Mark?
Yeah, just enlarge on what Taylor said. I completely agree. You know, this was a major issue throughout the history of Israel. David was one of the few that didn't engage in this, but his son Solomon did. Solomon built Asherah poles. Because of his wives later in his life. Isaiah wrote about it extensively. It was in the book of Judges earlier. Gideon destroyed one of these places in Judges. Hezekiah, as Taylor mentioned, did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and cut down the Asherah. But Manasseh, who ruled for 55 years, his son, built them all back up again. Josiah, young King Josiah, was one of the last kings that went and tried to tear all these poles down. And it wasn't until after the Babylonian captivity that the Israelites essentially, you know, were able to conquer this. But I just wanted to make the point that this idea of evergreen trees, which that's what this is talking about, going into a high place and having an evergreen tree and somehow having that associated with religious practice is seen today. You know, people in just a few weeks and by a month will be cutting down evergreen trees and putting them in their homes. And if you read about it, if you go back, most people say that this is associated with this idea of the solstice and of nature worship and so on. There's no biblical precept for this. And so it's taking a non-biblical concept and then using syncretism and melding it with what people consider to be religious concepts in the New Testament.
Thank you. We have several examples of worshiping under trees, worshiping false gods and idols under trees. As both of you mentioned, Taylor and Bart mentioned, building altars in the high places to be closer to God. Things like that were going to be a problem. And so we have the next question is about, well, if we're not supposed to worship in these places, that we're supposed to destroy these places, then where are we supposed to worship? Did you have a...
Yeah, one other thing, and I can't remember, I don't think it was Kaufman, but it might have been, pointed out that the practice of heathen nations, when one would overtake another, you know, they would destroy the people, but they would save the temples. They would save the temples of the nation they just defeated, and they'd basically just change out the furniture, put in different idols, and just set up their own system. This is completely different. The Lord wants all those places destroyed. I thought that was a pretty interesting point.
That is interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Okay, let's move on to question 2. Where would the Lord eventually put his name for his dwelling place that Israel might go and worship him? Bart?
This is basically a prediction of the future. The tabernacle was carried about by the Israelites for 40 years in the wilderness. Under Joshua's rule, it was placed in Shiloh in his time. And according to the commentators I read, a Jewish commentator, in fact, it was there 369 years in Shiloh. So a very, very long time until the death of Eli the priest. Remember, the ark was taken by the Philistines, and Eli fell and broke his neck. So the entire period of the Judges, it was in Shiloh. But then in the days of Samuel, it was in several different places, Mizpah, then at Nob. In King David's time, it was the Gibeon's threshing floor of Arbana. And then in Solomon's time, of course, it was on Temple Mount, which may have been the same place, we're not exactly sure, as the threshing floor of Arbana. But this Jerusalem then, the Mount Zion, is the place that God is speaking of, the place that he will choose. And that phrase, by the way, appears 21 times in the first 5 books, the Torah. And in this, we're going to be encountering this quite often in the next few chapters in Deuteronomy. This idea occurs in chapter 14 again, in chapter 15, in chapter 16, in chapter 17, in chapter 26, and in chapter 31. And it's speaking of in the future, you're going to do this at the place the Lord chooses. And some of this refers to the pilgrim festivals, Passover, Pentecost, and tabernacles, where the adult males and preferably all of the family would travel to this place where God would choose Jerusalem and worship God there.
So, are you, Bart, you probably have seen the controversy about whether this refers to Jerusalem specifically. I just wondered your thoughts, because I don't know the answer, and the commentaries that I usually go to, all of them agree that this doesn't necessarily mean Jerusalem.
Right, well, it's not, for me, it's not a difficult question. And really where this comes from is critical, German criticism. And they say that Book of Deuteronomy was not written until the 600s or the 500s, when Jerusalem was already established. And so it's not a prediction. It wasn't written by Moses. It was written by a priest in the 600s who wanted the worship of the Lord to occur at Jerusalem. That's what the textual critics say. And obviously, I reject that, and I'm sure you do too. It is indeed written by Moses, and there's very little, there's no proof that it was written by anyone else but Moses. But I think that's where that controversy comes from, because they say, oh, well, this is something that was written by somebody who's just trying to make Jerusalem central. There's all this politics of the day going on, and they want people to come to Jerusalem. But I think if you look at this from the context of David coming, who's going to be the king, who's a type of Christ, who established, is going to put the tabernacle in Jerusalem, and then Solomon, his son, is going to build the temple. I think, for me, it seems pretty clear. Obviously, it's never named Jerusalem, but I think it's pretty clear that Jerusalem was what it's referring to.
Yeah, I had seen that sort of, did Moses even write this sort of, and that wasn't what I was referring to. Kaufman, Keelan DeLitch, a few others, Kaufman said, this is where critics find all the nonsense that this means Jerusalem and nowhere else. And they're using the first part of your statement that Shiloh and Mizpah, all of those are places where God put his name, and that it's not just Jerusalem.
Right, well, and I agree with that in the sense that obviously I think God meant for it to be at Shiloh for that period of time, and for it to be at Nob and Mizpah. But I think the final resting place is indeed the Temple Mount, because that is where Abraham took Isaac, most likely. Most commentators say that at the very location where the temple was, the Temple Mount was where Abraham took Isaac and was ready to sacrifice him. And so in Zion, that location is mentioned throughout the prophetic works, Isaiah in the 800s and so on. So I tried to argue with Kaufman, but it just seems to me to make contextual sense it's Jerusalem.
Thanks for indulging my curiosity. Other comments? Taylor?
I agree with everything Bart said, and I think it's easy maybe to obscure some of this. I think the point of verse 5 is just worship me, worship God, where I say to worship, wherever that might be. And for us today, God has put his name sort of worldwide today, and to the significance of Jerusalem, like Bart said, something that had never struck me before, that idea of Jerusalem for the Jews being that ultimate resting place of God's worship, and then the destruction of that temple, the taking away of that from Israel, and then giving it essentially to the world. In a broader sense, I'd never appreciated that symbolism before. And I thought 1 Kings 8:29 is interesting, because Solomon, when he's praying, when the ark is being taken into the temple, he uses this exact phrase in reference to Jerusalem. He says that your eyes, God's eyes, may be open toward this temple in Jerusalem night and day, toward the place of which you said, my name shall be there, that you may hear the prayer which your servant makes toward this place. So as Bart mentioned, there's progression getting to Jerusalem, but then for us today, obviously, this still has significance, because God has told us where it doesn't matter for us to worship today, and then the how as well, as we mentioned earlier. A couple more small things within, one other thing about this idea of God not revealing where he would put his name. If you read the commentators, there are different suggestions as to why that might be. Maybe the enemies of Israel would fortify the place if God had said, I'm going to put it here. To me, I think the most reasonable explanation is just that the people would have been such a great thing to have in your city, in your tribe. You know, that would have been such a source of contention for Israel to fight over that, to want to be that tribe that everybody came to, that was the center of the worship, national unity, and all that. And so I think there's a lot of wisdom, obviously, in not revealing that before all the land is allotted. A couple small things, verse 6, this idea of heave offerings of your hand, that's referring to essentially voluntary heave offerings, not a free will per se, but something in addition to the required offerings, something more. And again, the point is that all these offerings that are given are going to go to the place that God would choose, whether that's Mizpah, whether that's Shiloh, Jerusalem, wherever it might be at the time. And then quickly on verse 7, there's a seeming contradiction between this and what we see in Numbers 18:18. There in Numbers 18:18, it seems that all flesh is going to the priest. Here it says that some may be taken by the offerers. It seems like Numbers 18 is directed toward the priests. Here it's directed more toward the people. And so I think the point is that some offerings the priests did get all of. But in Deuteronomy 12:7 is referring to these sort of shared offerings, offerings that some went to both. But that's something you'll encounter if you read different commentaries on this section.
Thank you. Other comments here? Okay, so that's Taylor's comments there, and I segue to our next question. Why was it important that Israel have one centralized location for bringing offerings to the Lord, referring to verses 8 through 14? Levi?
I'd say one, it's what God commanded. Two, a central place would prevent divisions, and rally promotes unity and purity. And three, a central place would bring people together.
Thank you. You have anything to add to Levi's comments? No?
Well, a central place would, as Levi pointed out, would bring everyone together. But it would also keep them out of the acacia groves and off the mountaintops and out from under the trees. So it was, here's what I want you to do and where I want you to do it. And I thought it'd be important to also realize that by having a centralized location, the tribe of Levi could fulfill their responsibility much easier and be able to be in charge and do their best to keep Israel on task and obedient to God's instructions as best they could.
Just to add a little bit to what Bill said there, it would keep them out of those places and it would take them somewhere where supposedly you would think that these religious ceremonies would be conducted correctly by the priests.
Other comments? Bart?
I thought of Shahane and what he taught us in 1 Corinthians 11. Remember the word sunerikomai? It's four or five times in 1 Corinthians 11, when you come together to eat the Lord's Supper, and that word sunerikomai, and it just means to gather together. And so I thought of the obvious parallel between the people of Israel being unified by one, every time they offer sacrifice, they have to go to wherever the tabernacle is. And then two, in the time of Jerusalem, when they have the three great feasts, the people all come together, and it promotes unity. And it's the same with us in the church, obviously. We come together to worship. We don't worship individually. We come together to worship, and we're told at the beginning of 1 Corinthians to do all things with the same heart, the same mind, in unity.
I saw this as maybe symbolic or maybe encapsulating this crossing over into Jordan. They've been wandering through the wilderness. They've been following these rules about sacrifices to the best they can with some variations there. But it's been irregular. They haven't had a central location. They haven't had any sort of constant worshiping place because they've been traveling. Now they're going to cross over into a stable rest. They're going to enter that rest, and part of that is they're going to have regularity and they're going to have consistency in their worship practices. They're going to have the central location that's going to make life easier, and so it's part of the rest is how I saw it. Other comments? Taylor?
One quick thing on that. It's easy to skip over verse 8, but that struck me, that phrase that's used, every man doing whatever's right in his own eyes, we always associate with judges and that idea of complete, you know, loss of any sort of religious regularity. So it's kind of strange to see it in this section, because Moses has been presiding over the people. Granted, they rebelled and gone off into all these different errors in their time in the wilderness, but it would seem like that's not anything close to what we see in Judges, where there was no sort of religious structure. And so I think the point of that phrase here is that it was a sort of selective enforcement of God's laws. You know, what was laid down, there were limitations as to what the people could or couldn't do, because you're wandering in the wilderness, you don't have a lot of crops. You know, not a centralized location in the sense of the temple, bringing all these sacrifices here. There are all these limitations to go off of what you just said when you're in the wilderness. And when you get to Canaan, there won't be any more of these irregularities. There won't be any more of doing the best you can, so to speak, with what you have, because you'll have everything in Canaan. There won't be any excuses for not following to the letter of the law. And then verse 12, the idea of rejoicing before the Lord your God. It's a phrase that's used frequently in Deuteronomy in connection with worship, with festivals, with offerings that are being given. And I think, unfortunately, that can sometimes stand in contrast to the way that we might view offerings and worship and sort of our get-togethers, festivals, if you will. That's something that we all have to keep in mind, that that's the attitude that we need to have when we go up to worship the Lord.
Okay, let's move on to question 4. What could be eaten at home and what needed to be consumed before the Lord? We're in verses 15 to 19. Linda?
Well, they could consume essentially everything besides blood, which they could consume at neither place. They could consume any meat that their heart desired, but they couldn't consume meat that they would offer to the Lord. They would have to do that at the tabernacle before the Lord. And so, as Taylor mentioned earlier, we have the same thing today. You can't go to a hotel room and partake of the Lord's Supper there. You have to come to where the brethren meet to do so.
So this is there's an interesting parallel. If you remember our study in Acts, when the Jerusalem decree is written, in Acts 15, verse 29, it says that it seemed good to the Holy Spirit that the people should have that they should have nothing, no greater burden than these necessary things, that you abstain from things offered to idols, from blood, and from things strangled. And we talked about that when we went through Acts. But I recall that passage as something that's brought over, one of the rare dietary guidelines that we still have today. That's a New Testament command to abstain from blood and from things strangled. Other thoughts on these dietary rules?
Just one small thing, maybe it's easy to overlook within this section. Previously in Leviticus 17, verses 3 to 6, animals were to be slain in the midst of the camp at the tabernacle. And so going forward, again, as you mentioned, when Israel goes over into Canaan, spreads out, there's centralized worship, but obviously it's not feasible to travel several days' journey, go slaughter an animal, then take it back. It's going to spoil by the time you get it back. And so this was a very practical consideration for Israel, because the city or the people would not be as centralized as they were in the past. This would allow them much more ease in slaughtering animals. And then I got kind of confused. Maybe it was just about the ending of verse 15 in the New King James, that the unclean and unclean and clean may eat of it. That's referring, as far as I can tell, to the Israelites. So in other words, it doesn't matter whether an Israelite was clean or unclean, they could still partake of it. That's not talking about the animals mentioned there, because both of those could not be offered as sacrifices, but they were considered clean animals. We see that in Deuteronomy 14:5 a little bit later when we get into clean and unclean animal distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's referring to the people, and they no longer have these restrictions that you have to be in a certain state before you can partake. Anything else? Okay, question 5. How is the blood of slaughtered animals to be handled?
This question appears pretty straightforward. Basically, they take the blood, they'd separate it from the meat, and they'd pour it on the ground. We do the exact same thing today when we go hunting. If we kill a deer, we string it up and we let the blood drain out of it. They did the exact same thing. But it's interesting that in verse 23 it refers to the blood as the life. You know, it's separating. It's kind of a spiritual and physical separation in that sense, I would say.
Thank you. Any thoughts on this question?
Nope. I've also read that in the ancient world, almost every animal that was slaughtered was first offered as a sacrifice to their gods, and then the people would eat it. So the Lord again is drawing a major line between these are the animals for me, these are the animals you can consume, you and your family. Eat, eat. I thought that was an interesting phrase, eat till your heart's content. You know, just different way of handling these two types of situations.
People still do this today, obviously. There's this idea in ancient paganism that if you drank the blood of a particular animal, that it would give you the power of the animal. Jessica and I watched a documentary on Netflix recently that, I forget exactly which continent it was on, but the people that were involved, they slew an animal, and then they had this procedure where the young men would drink the blood of the animal, and the idea was you receive part of the spirit of the animal. You know, it could be strong as an ox, or fast as a deer, or as brave as a lion. So that's an idea of ancient paganism, and it's still very much in our culture. Occasionally you'll see a movie like The Deer Hunter or whatever, where the person who kills their first deer, you know, takes a bite of the heart. And that's an ancient pagan thing. And as you said, it is prohibited for Christians. We are prohibited from doing that by the Jerusalem decree in Acts 15. And it's interesting, it says here that the blood is the life. Jesus says that he who drinks my blood and eats my body has eternal life. So that is the connection for us. You know, when we take part of the Lord's Supper and do it correctly as obedient Christians, then we have eternal life, and so we gain life. And so perhaps that's why there's this prohibition on blood, because the blood is the life, and it's fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The fruit of the vine representing the blood gives us life when we drink it. And so I just think that is, it's obviously an interesting connection, and I thought about the Jews in Jesus' day and how they were repulsed, and I meant to look up the scripture for this, and I didn't, but some of the disciples left the Lord at one point during his ministry, and it was exactly because of this idea. He was telling them that if you drink my blood and eat my body, then you will have life, and these were Jewish individuals who had been raised on this Mosaic idea, and they were repulsed by this concept, and they left.
And that goes to the very root of what blood atonement is. It's giving a life for a life. That's the power, the symbolic power that's given to it. To go off what Bart said a little bit, the way blood is regarded and used, obviously in the ancient world, and as you mentioned, still today in some cultures, there's that aspect of it. We know, it seems at least, that this, I couldn't find any good scholarly evidence that, you know, that the regional deities, Canaanite gods, goddesses, were worshipped with blood sacrifice. But when Elijah confronts the prophets of Baal, he tells them at one point to cut yourself, let your blood out. And I don't think that was just him being mean. I think that was probably an aspect of worship that they did for whatever symbolic reason, stimulate their god. And so it was an ancient practice of the region. And as Bart mentioned, there's still something occult, something that's forbidden about blood. People today, witchcraft, that's always been an aspect of it. I thought of horror movies, you know. It's all awful, regardless anyway, somebody dies. But blood is often so prominent in those. And many times, even just the blood itself, many iconic scenes, blood on a shower curtain or going down a drain, those are so impactful, even though it's just blood. But there's something humanly powerful about blood, and that's why verse 23, I was really surprised to learn this, but when it says only be sure that you do not eat the blood, that phrase, the word for sure, carries with it the idea of strength or firmness. So Moses isn't just saying be sure, but he's saying literally be strong not to eat the blood. In other words, there's a serious temptation. He's saying vigorously resist this temptation, because again, not only was it something that your neighbors were doing, that people even today still do, there's something that draws people to that idea of blood and the occult, that aspect of life. And so very strongly resist this temptation.
That's very interesting. I hadn't read that about you, sure. You know, there are places today where, and several of you mentioned that this happens today, where I just want to clarify, not even in a pagan or ritualistic sense. If you travel to the Philippines, you can get a dishes where they pour the blood over it. And so, and we have churches there. You might be traveling in the Philippines, and you need to be aware of that. If you travel to Scotland and you order black pudding, that's congealed blood, I think. I didn't look this up beforehand, because it's very gross. But we need to be careful. This is one of the few restrictions about what we can consume and what we should avoid that has carried over to the New Testament. Any other comments on that question? Okay, so our last question. What grave warning does Moses relay to the people about how they worship God? Bill?
Well, there's the way I saw it, there's a couple here in these verses. Let's start with verse 30. Verse 30 is another serious warning. Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them. You can see this happening as God and Israel destroy nations of people and move into these cities and into these areas, and now the curiosity starts coming up. I think I would be like that. I'd be curious about this people. You know, how they lived, how they worked, how they worshipped. You know, I think it would be a temptation. And I think that's human nature. And it's kind of similar to our first question, you know. Going back, the Lord wanted these places totally destroyed, but in the process of Israel going through a nation, can't you see stumbling onto things in a household, on a street corner? I mean, it's a temptation. So I think that's the first warning. The second warning there in verse 32. Whatever command given, be careful. Be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it nor take away from it. And this is John chapter 4, verse 24. You know, to worship in spirit and in truth. And he's warning Israel. And you know, it's the same warning that was given at the end of chapter 11. And you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today. That's verse 32 of chapter 11. Very, very similar to our verse 32 here. So, you know, it was mentioned a couple of times already. Despite the very specific instruction in verse 31 about offering children, you know, it's I think Taylor touched on it maybe first. King Ahaz, 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 3. The king of Judah offered his son to Molech. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 7. I think maybe Bart might have mentioned it. Here's Solomon. He builds a temple to Molech. And then 2 Kings chapter 21 and verse 6. King Manasseh, I think either Taylor or Bart also mentioned that, gave his son to Molech. So here you have straight on, don't do this, and here's Israel doing it yet again.
Yeah, Trace.
I like the part in verse 32 where it says not to add to what God has already commanded. We always look to Revelation chapter 22, verse 18 and 19, but in Proverbs chapter 30, we have chapter 30, verse 5 and 6, it says, every word of God is pure. He is a shield to those who put their trust in him. Do not add to his word, lest he rebuke you and you be found a liar.
I didn't think about the curiosity angle. That's an interesting one. And obviously that's something that we would all struggle with. But as I understand it, in this region of the world, there was a belief among these different nations that when you moved into a new country, if you ignored the, you know, God's were regional. And so if you moved in and you ignored those gods, you didn't sacrifice, pay homage to them, or whatever, you would bring disaster upon yourself. In 2 Kings 17, verse 26, when the king of Assyria sends people to settle Samaria after the Israelites have been removed, and God sends judgment, that's what they attribute it to, that we don't know how to pay homage to these local gods. How do we do it? And so that was an aspect, and presumably Israel would have been caught up in that to some extent. They would have felt that need, that we're going into the land of the Baals and the Ashtaroths. How do we appease them and keep from having any sort of judgment on ourselves? So again, Moses is trying to head off that tendency for them to want to inquire after these local gods. And verse 32 has already been touched on quite a bit, but this is a connection. It's important. It's easy to overlook that, but it's a connection between what we see at the end of chapter 12 and then the rest of chapter 13. You've got an introduction on apostasy. And so here, God, you know, which Moses repeats over and over, don't follow after the foreign gods, stick to what God has given you. And then verse 32, as has been mentioned, whatever I command, be sure to do it. And then chapter 13 is for with those that don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wondered if this was maybe the arbitrary chapter divide was splitting this up in a way that maybe doesn't follow how I was reading it, which is the beginning of chapter 12 says, utterly destroy the places of worship, and then says, here's how you should worship. And then starting in verse 29 of chapter 12, it repeats the same thing as Bill said, and it says, you need to utterly destroy it says, destroy from before you, don't inquire after the other gods, etc., as a preamble to now we're going to talk about idol worshiping. And so you have the same situation, which is you need to utterly destroy everything about where they worship, and here's what you should do instead. Now we're ending it with, you need to utterly destroy the things that they worship, and we're going to talk about that next week.